You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. In these podcasts, we meet visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will shape our edible future. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and gastronaut. Today, we're exploring the future of cultivated meat. Once considered the ultimate Frankenstein food, lab-grown meat is now being touted as one of the greatest solutions to our environmental and food system challenges. It's predicted that by 2040, a third of all meat will not come from dead animals. So how do you convince people to ditch the beef burger and reach for the slaughter-free steak? And why cultivated meat when plant-based protein is doing so well? Well, joining me today are a fantastic panel. We've got Che Connon, co-founder and CEO of 3D Biotissues Limited and also Professor of Tissue Engineering at Newcastle University. Hello, Che.
Hello.
Didier Trubier, co-founder and CEO of Aleph Farms.
Hello, Stefanum.
And Peter Verstrata, co-founder and chief operating officer of Mosameat.
Hello.
Now, Peter, let's start off with you. You were one of the creators of the first cellular meat burger. And I remember back in 2013, I was desperate to be there for the unveiling of the first burger. I didn't make it, but it's been an extraordinary journey. Can you give us a brief history of cellular meat?
Sure. So the basic idea is actually quite old, like pre-World War II. Old. But the first person to take action here was a Dutchman called Willem van Eele. He patented cultured meat already in the 90s, so roughly 25 years ago today, and secured a subsidy from the Dutch government at the time to initiate the first ever research effort that was directed at making meat through tissue engineering. And this all happened in the zeros in the Netherlands. It involved several universities. And I was in that project as a representative of a meat company, actually, a meat company I was working for at the time. And in the course of that same project, I met Mark Post, who stepped in somewhere halfway and who was, well, as fascinated by this as I was. And probably looking back now, one of the key criteria for the continued interest and the growing interest in the media, for instance, was the fact that Mark, when this project had ended, roughly around 2009, 2010, decided to continue to work on this technology at his lab, the lab that he ran as a professor at Maastricht University, which in itself led to a lot of publicity and contacts with Sergey Brin's team, who's one of the founders of Google, and who ended up financing this burger you already referred to in 2013. And yeah, looking back again, I guess that was the event that triggered the emergence of what's now a small field of like 50, 60 companies worldwide that all work on this technology in various ways, on various species, but they're all trying to go to the market as soon as they can.
It's always the Dutch, isn't it? It's always the Dutch who start things off like this. What is it in the Netherlands that makes you so forward-thinking about food and food technology?
I don't know. We have a very, very strong agricultural history. I mean, I'm training myself at an agricultural university, actually, as a food technician. So we're sort of immersed with efficient production of foodstuff. We're the second largest exporter of agricultural products in the world, just behind the US. It's in our veins. And we've been sailing the seas ever since the 16th century.
It really is, isn't it? Yeah. And I love that, from market gardening to cellular meat. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's move on to Didier. Now, Didier, can you just explain to us, I think I know this, but can you tell me anyway, why is cultivated meat good? Because obviously it gets a lot of flack as the Frankenstein of food. But what are the advantages of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. First, to build on what Peter said, Peter is very humble and modest, but has been really the driver behind this industry very, very early on. And I think he should be an inspiration for all of us.
I hope you're blushing, Peter.
I'm from ear to ear.
Sorry, Didier, carry on.
Yeah. The first approach is to eat less meat. The issue is that practically that does not work. And the demand for meat continues to increase globally. Even in the US, which has been one of the pioneers of this new generation of plant-based products like Impossible and Beyond, the meat consumption continues to increase. What we do at within the cultivated meat industry is something completely different, is sticking to the product, to meat, We're not an alternative meat product. We just changed the production process for meat. And we believe that once there will be real meat in the market, but without the downsides, we will see a significant acceptance. And beyond that, cultivated meat is also a great solution for food security. And with the climate change, stress on securing high quality nutrition for anyone, anywhere.
Okay, Jay, let's talk a little bit about the ethical aspects of cultivated meat. Now, am I right in thinking that you are not using bovine serum as the base substance for meat? Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, in that we are developing a media supplement that will allow us to remove the serum from the media.
And so just to be clear, the importance of this, I assume, would be that in ethical terms, it is not based on meat. How important is this aspect?
I guess the two pillars upon which the cultivated meat explosion has occurred, mix my metaphors, is the ethical and the environmental perceived benefits or hoped for benefits. But of course, difficult to define, and one can argue over from each direction. But of course, in general, the reduction in animals or the deaths of animals is a good thing, as is the reduction in greenhouse gases and land use are good things. We know that the global calories, demand for global calories is set to increase hugely, 70% by 2050, it says in one report. And that requires us to think differently about how we produce these calories or proteins. And, you know, it really does point to radical dietary kind of shifts away from animal-derived products.
Yeah. Now, I'd like to call on your public engagement skills as Professor of Tissue Engineering. Can you give us a very simple explanation of the challenge? How do you make cultivated meat?
Yeah, well, I got into the area through trying to tissue engineer transplantable materials, you know, pieces of body. They have to be functional to work, and at that higher level, completely functional. You know, it can't be just halfway house. It has to work fully out of the box. And the advantages of the tissue engineered meat sector is it doesn't have to be completely functional out of the box. It doesn't, the muscle that you're using in a burger doesn't need to behave in the same way that muscle would originally worked inside the animal. This gives you an advantage in kind of allowing you to break the challenge down somewhat. And also, it seems that, at least in the business models, I understand that the hope is that the customers will also accept that. So you start off with a simple or relatively simple pâté, and then build up to a steak of some description as the technologies come on board.
Now, Peter, let's talk about taking all of this into the mainstream. You're saying a couple of years away before we start seeing things produced on at scale. I mean, it relates presumably very closely to cost. What are the issues here? Why does it cost so much to produce a burger? And what are the aspects that will solve that problem?
Indeed, it depends on cost. It also depends on capacity. And those are two different things, actually. So the price needs to be right at par with meat, at least with meat alternatives at first, but ultimately closer to traditional meat. And like I said, you need to be able to make huge quantities. If you do the math and you look at cell densities that you can reach in a bioreactor, you'd need hundreds of thousands of very, very large bioreactors globally to produce a significant part of current meat consumption.
Just before you carry on, when you say a bioreactor, are we talking a big bowl?
Well, again, it depends on what technology path you follow. In our case, we have, roughly speaking, a two-stage process. Stage one is proliferating cells, which indeed is, well, a big bowl in your words. So it's a vessel that contains a soup that the cells like, in which they proliferate from a few into large, extremely large quantities and in various steps. Stage two, at least in our case, is that we harvest these cells and then bring them into a system in which they do what they're good at, which is make muscle tissue. It's actually the same cells that repair our muscle when we are injured. Those are the cells that we use to produce muscle cells, muscle fibers outside of the body. But because there's no off-the-shelf product that can do that, there's simply been no question in the market up to today to, you know, to be able to make tons of animal tissue through tissue engineering. It's a small scale science field so far.
And I mean, the Impossible Burgers and Beyond Burgers, they are expensive, aren't they? It's not a cheap product. So there is presumably an appetite for a premium product. People are likely to pay more because of other aspects, because of you know, issues about animal cruelty and things like that. So you've got to step up there to begin with, haven't you?
To a certain extent, you know, if you want to gain the acceptance of the mainstream consumer here, you really need to be close to the price of traditional meat. Ultimately, it's price is one of the biggest drivers. And we're not, don't get me wrong, we're not doing this to only have a commercially interesting venue in our hands. We're doing this to make a difference in the food system. And for that, you need to come up with a technology that can replace meat long term.
The aspect of this that fascinates me is that it's such a technical challenge, and it's been worked on for a long time. And yet the plant-based alternative meat market they've kind of got there first, certainly in terms of scale. Is there an argument that we've got the plant-based stuff, we don't really need cellular meat? What's the impetus for pushing ahead with cultivating meat?
That's a good point. And actually, there is an argument to argue that we don't need cultured meat, or maybe in a broader sense, there's an argument to be made that we don't need meat. So you can reverse this by saying we need cultured meat as much as we need traditional meat. So from a nutritional point of view, most of us can do without it. I mean, there are many vegetarians on this planet, but that's not the whole story. There's also the craving for meat, and that's a strong force. And it's only really satisfied with a product that offers the same experience that meat gives us. And the majority of consumers are simply not willing to let go of meat yet, despite many of them realizing that meat consumption is getting out of hand on many levels. And that's where cultured meat comes in, because that's exactly the promise of cultured meat, to offer that experience, to satisfy that craving while, you know, eradicating virtually all of those downsides of our traditional meat.
And in terms of progress for the industry, how far away are you from real scale?
It depends on what you call, you know, what end products you're going for. I can give you our answer, and we're going for minced meat. And we expect it to be like 2-3 years from today when we can, let's say, seriously go to the markets with quantities that are enough to go to restaurants, a few stores, before you find cultured meat on the corner of the streets in your everyday supermarkets. That's got to be closer to 10 to 5 years from today, probably.
And there's finance to be able to take us that far. The potential benefits from this are still there because there's still funding around for cellular meat, isn't there? It's a rich ground for investors.
It is. It's high risk. It still is. I mean, we still need to give the definite proof that the scalability is there. I guess we're all, including myself, really convinced that that will happen, but it still needs to happen. But the upside of investing in this technology is that you're potentially disrupting a 1-point-something trillion. I don't even know how many zeros that is, but a 1-point-something trillion market that is in bad need for disruption. So it's a huge opportunity with still a significant risk associated to it today.
Yeah. Okay, now Didier, from a consumer perspective, how are you going to convince people that this is the product they should buy over and above traditional meat or plant-based protein?
Yeah, it's obviously a very important question. I think in any new category of food, the way this meat is introduced and the narrative and the the familiarity with the technique would be important, meaning studies show that the more the consumers heard about cultivated meat before and are familiar with the technology, that they would and the benefits, the acceptance would be higher. Overall, based on the last surveys we have performed in the UK and in the US, we see an overall expected acceptance of above 75% in the global population. And with the younger generation really driving the acceptance with the rates above 90%, 90, the Generation Z, with the drivers which are different for the younger population, the primary motivators for potentially switching to cultivated meat are primarily focused on animal welfare and environmental benefits, while for the older generation, the main benefits perceived with cultivated meat are based on health and nutrition, and namely using no antibiotics and the ability to optimize the nutritional profile of meat, and especially red meat, with less saturated fat and cholesterol. So the market is, we believe, ready for it. Of course, there will be some challenges making sure we turn this expected acceptance into an actual purchase act in the grocery store. But it looks relatively promising on that end.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Che, when you go out for, when you used to go out for dinner or down to the pub, and people learn that you are a professor of tissue engineering dealing in cultivated meats, did people sort of talk about the concept of Frankenstein food? Were they appalled at the idea? And do you think that the attitudes have changed specifically because of the growth of the plant-based meat market?
Yes, I think the attitudes are changing and changing quite rapidly. When I cast my mind back to a couple of years ago, when you first mentioned the concept, people were like, "Ooh, no!" But it's grabbed public opinion and in generally, fortunately, so far, in a very positive way. Of course, people like Peter and Didier are going to be very, and myself, very keen to maintain that kind of positive note and not let any kind of strange kind of pseudoscience creep in that kind of scares everybody off, in the same way that it is other types of technology in and around food that we know of. It's been very positive. You can have interesting conversations in the pub or used to around kind of bizarre or extreme examples just for fun. But on the whole, yeah, very, very positive, feedback. Yeah.
I saw the phrase Frankenstein foods used a lot in the media. Now, I think the media loves a story like that because they can rail against it. Do you think that the media approach to, engineered foods reflects or doesn't reflect the view of consumers generally?
I think the media are still catching up with where we are. I'm just thinking, it could be a really good time for any of these types of technologies to come through in the media. I'm just thinking about the COVID situation, and we often hear that everybody's relying on the scientists. The scientists have really come through with the vaccines and showing the world that science, is a force for good, and can have a real positive effect. And I think that's really gripped people, and I hope that continues. So it might be, I think it would be, and the press are, fickle and easily led. So they're not going to suddenly try to, in the face of COVID and all the positive news from science, they're not going to try and paint scientists as bad guys at the moment. I don't think. So it's a good time.
Now, just to take this on a slightly different tack here, Didier, we've read a little bit about cultivated meat, the potential for cultivated meat as pet food. Now, the insect protein industry has there's a large part of it which is dedicated to animal feed. There's also quite a lot of moves, certainly in South Africa, to create pet food rather than animal feed from insects. Is there a fit here with cultivated meat? Do you think it might be a good idea to produce cultivated meat pet food, or would that be cannibalizing your market potential?
Using cultivated meat for pet food could drive a significant impact globally. It's not our route. It's not the strategy of Alliphants. We focus on quality meat and good food. And we believe that starting with a product which is appealing and meets the consumer expectations would be critical for cultivated meat to be a real alternative to slaughtered meat on the long term. Starting with pet food on our end is not an option, but other companies do that, and I believe that they have met the math and they believe that it's attractive.
And you're based in Israel, I believe. Is that right?
It is.
Yeah. So, I mean, Israel, again, a little bit like the Netherlands, it's a real hotbed for food technology. Mm-hmm. Do you think Israelis are ready to eat cultivated meat?
Of course. And not only Israelis. Many other countries are ready as well. But I would say that in Israel, beyond the fact that we have a fantastic ecosystem with a high level of collaboration between the industry, the academy, and the government, we also have one of the highest level of awareness of animal welfare issues. Israel has been the first country historically to ban force feeding of goose for liver, for foie gras. And we're currently working very closely with the GFI, for instance, in Israel to promote a national plan for alternative protein to promote not only the local economy, but also the food security in Israel. And we believe that countries like Israel, like other countries in the Middle East, in Asia, you know, in China, 90% of the beef is imported, 65% in Japan, and close to 100% in Singapore. And the ability to produce meat anytime, anywhere, without relying on local and natural resources and under any climate, which is possible with cultivated meat, is a very strategic project. And so we believe that cultivated meat, beyond just providing a great product, a tasty and nutritious product, we also have a significant geopolitical role in promoting global stability on the long term.
Now, Che, could you? I'd just like you to have a very quick moment to sell me lab-grown meat. What if you know you're based in Newcastle? You know, you've got your lads out on the town at night. Do you think that there is an acceptance level now for a lab-grown curry?
If I was to sell you a lab-grown curry today, and not based on a lab-grown curry of tomorrow or that in 5 years' time, I think it would be selling it to you on its ethical credentials and environmental credentials. You know, you are eating this curry, and you are, you know, saving a certain amount of land from being used for grazing cattle, or you're reducing greenhouse gas emissions by X percentage. That's how I would sell it at the moment. I wouldn't be selling it on necessarily on the quality or the meat experience per se, the texture so much. I'd today it would have to be sold, in my opinion, on those environmental credentials.
Yeah. And I wonder also, Che, are we being a little bit too conservative here in just focusing on replicating meat? I mean, you have the potential to create something that hasn't been seen before. Well, you know, is there a brand new taste and textural experience that you're open to? Or is it very much the idea of replacing something that already exists? I mean, what about something we've never heard of before?
Yeah, I agree. I think from, you know, you're getting mixed in with investment and marketing and things like that, where if we come up with a dodo burger right now, it might seem a little bad taste.
So we're T-Rex burger.
T-Rex, but all those things might be possible once, I think, we've ironed out some of the initial kind of concerns, and then so there'll be perhaps there'll be a second or third wave of more punk type meat, which is a bit kind of on the extreme edges of things, but certainly yeah, very much feasible. Yeah.
Human burger.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I mean, what about the Elvis Presley burger?
Oh, now you're talking, mind you, that's going to be quite fatty, isn't it?
It's really disgusting. No.
This is the thing that we're not allowed to talk about.
Yeah. Is that true? Is everyone's a bit reluctant to talk about that potential. Is that right, Didier?
I really don't connect to this type of crazy ideas. It's really not the direction the industry should go. You know, like any new technology in the world, like a knife or the internet, you know, technology can be used for human progress, or can also be used for bad intentions.
I mean, that is a very responsible approach to take, but I know that all three of you go home after a day at work thinking, I'm going to recreate my dog and I'm going to eat it. That's true, isn't it?
Really not. It's not that. You know, if you want to eat a dog, you can eat a dog today. You don't need cultivated meat to do that. I really don't see the point. And to your earlier question about whether we should reproduce exactly the meat we know or not, I think that the idea of cultivated meat is to become a new category of meat products. I don't think that the idea is necessarily to be a one-to-one substitute of one specific meat cut of one specific terroir or breed. Same as we have today, white wine and red wine, which is an analogy I use sometimes, which are two different types of wines, two categories of wines, sharing the same basic attributes, being wines, but with a slightly different value proposition and not necessarily interchangeable. I believe that in 5, 10 years, 15 years, we'll have two categories of meat. Slaughter-based meat, which is harvested from the carcass of a slaughtered animal, and we'll have a slaughter-free meat, like a cultivated meat, with a different value proposition, sharing the same basic attributes, the nutritional value, the experience of meat, the unique sensory experience, including the cooking and the culinary experience, but still with a different value proposition and probably targeting different segments of the consumer or different opportunities for meat eating.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay. Peter, sell lab-grown meat to me as a consumer. What makes it something that I want to put my money on the table for and buy?
Well, primarily what makes it delicious is what makes meat delicious. So imagine a sunny afternoon, the burning barbecue, the smell of sizzling hamburgers roasting. Like I said earlier, eating meat is an experience, and it's one we find very hard to let go. And what makes cultured meat delicious is that it gives you all that same sensation, that same experience that meat gives you, because it's biologically identical to traditional meat. It just doesn't have all those downsides. And, you know, that also defines, I think, at least the mission of that we should have as an industry. Anything less than that will maybe give you products that have, you know, some commercial potential, but so they can coexist with meat, but they will not be able to replace meat long-term. So the selling point is that it's so close to meat that even Joe Meat doesn't mind swapping to the other camp anymore.
Excellent. Well, Che, Didier and Peter, get a move on, please, because I'd like to start eating some of your cultivated meat. And thank you so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. And you heard from Che Connon, Didier Toubier, Peter Vestrate and me, Stephen Gates. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from agri-tech investment to precision farming. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.